did by way of sand paintings, which are mostly mandalas, on the ground, and then the person who is to be treated moves into the mandala. There will be a mythological context that he will be identifying with, and he identifies himself with that power. And this idea of sand painting with mandalas and used for meditation purposes appears also in Tibet, in the great tantric monasteries outside of Lhasa, for instance, Gyutdo. They practiced sand painting, cosmic images and so forth, indicating the forces of the spiritual powers that operate in our lives.
Now, what do you make of that, that in two very different cultures, the same imagery emerges?
Yes. Well, there are only two ways to explain it, and one is by diffusion, that an influence came from there to here, and the other is by separate development. And when you have the idea of separate development, this speaks for certain powers in the psyche, which are common to all mankind. Otherwise, you couldn't have, and to the detail the correspondences can be identified, it's astonishing when one studies these things in depth, the degree to which the agreements go between totally separated cultures.
Which says something about the commonality of the species, doesn't it?
Well, yes. That was Carl Jung's idea, which he calls the archetypes of the collective unconscious.
What do you mean by archetype?
An archetype is a constant form, a basic fundamental form which appears in the works of that person over there and this person over here without connection. And they are expressions of the structure of the human psyche.
So if you find in a variety of cultures, each one telling the story of creation, or the story of a virgin birth, or the story of a savior who comes and dies and is resurrected, you're saying something about what is inside us and the need to understand.
That's right. One can say that the images of myth are reflections of spiritual and depth potentialities of every one of us. And that through contemplating those, we evoke those powers in our own lives to operate through ourselves. There was a very important anthropologist, he's the one with whom my works begin, you might say, my studies, Bastian in Germany, end of the last century and first part of this. He was a world traveler and recognized very soon that there were certain motifs that appeared in all of the religions and all the mythologies of the world. Such an idea, for example, as a spiritual power. That's an archetypal image that appears everywhere. And he called these elementary ideas. But they appear in very different forms in different provinces and at different times. And those different forms or costumes he called ethnic or folk ideas. But within the ethnic idea is the elementary idea. And it is those elementary ideas that Carl Jung then began studying and called archetypes of the unconscious. When you say elementary idea, they seem to come from up here. When you say archetypes of the unconscious, they come from up here. And they appear in our dreams as well as in the myths.
So when one scripture talks about being made in his image, in God's image, it's being created with certain qualities that every human being possesses, no matter what that person's religion or culture or geography or heritage.
God would be the ultimate elementary idea of man.
The primal need.
And we are all made in the image of God, okay? So that is the ultimate elementary idea or archetype of man.
I feel stronger in my own faith, knowing that others had the same yearnings and were seeking for the same images to try to express an experience that couldn't be costumed in ordinary human language.
That's right.
I feel much more kinship with all those who follow other ways, because it's
this is why clowns are good
clowns?
In religions, because they show that the image is not a fact, but it's a reflex of some kind.
So does this help explain the trickster gods that show up?
Very much that, yes. Some of the best trickster stories are associated with our American Indian tales. Now, these figures are clown-like figures, and yet they are the creator god at the same time very often. And this makes the point, I am not the ultimate image, I am transparent to something. Through me, through my funny form, and mocking it, and turning it into a grotesque action, you really get the sense, which if I had been a big sober presence, you'd get stuck with the image.
There's a wonderful story in some African tradition of the god who's walking down the road, and the god has on a hat that is colored red on one side and blue on the other side. So when the farmers in the field go in to the village in the evening, they said, "Did you see that fellow, that god with the blue hat?" And the others said, "No, he had a red hat on," and they get into a fight.
He even makes it worse by first walking along this direction, then turning his hat around so that again it'll be red and black or whatever. And then when these two chaps fight and are brought before the king or chief for judgment, this fellow appears and he says, "It's my fault, I did it. Spreading strife is my greatest joy."
And there's a truth in that.
There sure is, yes.
Which is?
No matter what system of thought you have, it can't possibly include boundless life. And when you think everything's just that way, the trick comes in, it all blows, and you get the becoming thing again. Now, Jung has a wonderful saying somewhere. Religion is a defense against a religious experience.
Well, you have to explain that.
Well, that means it has reduced the whole thing to concepts and ideas. And having the concept and idea short circuits the transcendent experience. The experience of deep mystery is what one has to regard as the ultimate religious experience.
Well, there are many Christians who believe that to find out who Jesus is, you have to go past the Christian faith, past the Christian doctrine, past the Christian church. And I know that's heresy to a lot of people. But
well, you have to go past the image of Jesus. The image of God becomes the final obstruction. Your God is your ultimate barrier. This is basic Hinduism, basic Buddhism. The idea of the ascent of the spirit through the centers, the chakras as they're called, or lotuses, the different centers of experience, the animal experiences of hunger and greed, or just the zeal of reproduction, or the physical mastery of one kind or another. These are all stages of power. But then when the center of the heart is reached, and the sense of compassion on another person, mercy and participation, and I and you are in some sense of the same being, this is what marriage is based on. There's a whole new stage of life experience opens up with the opening of the heart. And this is what's called the virgin birth, actually, the birth of a spiritual life in what formerly was simply a human animal, living for the animal aims of health, progeny, wealth, and a little fun. But now you come to something else, to participate in this sense of accord with another, or accord with some principle that has lodged in your mind as a good to be identified with, then a whole new life comes. And this is, in Oriental thinking, the awakening of the religious experience. And then this can go on even to the quest for the experience of the ultimate mystery. Now, this ultimate mystery can be experienced in two senses. One, without form, and other with form. And in this Oriental thinking, you experience God with form here. This is heaven. That's the identification with your own being, because that which God refers to is the ultimate mystery of being, which is the mystery of your being as well as of the world. So this is it.
How do you explain what the psychologist Maslow calls peak experiences and what your friend James Joyce called epiphanies? I love that word, epiphany.
Oh, well, they're not quite the same.
But, I know.
The peak experience it refers to actual moments of your life when you feel that this has told you something. Something has come through in your experience of your relationship to the harmony of being. It can come. My peak experiences, I mean, the ones that I knew were peak experiences after I had them all came in athletics.
Which was the Everest of your experience?
Yeah. Well,
which one was it? Was when you were running at Columbia?
Yes, of course. And I ran a couple of races. It was just beautiful. And the whole race, I knew I was going to win. And there was no reason for me to know I was going to win because I was touched off anchor in a relay with the first man 30 yards ahead of me. And I just knew it was the peak experience. Nobody could beat me today. That's a kind of being in full form and really doing it. I don't think I've ever done anything in my life as competently as I ran those two races. And those, consequently, were the experience of really being at my full and doing perfect job. I don't think I've ever had anything like that quite, that I really came up to anything quite that way.
Do you think you, Joseph Campbell, it has to be physical?
No, but it can be a peak experience. There are other kinds of peak experiences which I know were superior to those, but those are the ones that when I read Maslow and read the peak experience, I just know that those were peak experiences.
What about James Joyce's epiphanies?
Now, that's another thing. This has to do with the aesthetic experience. Joyce's formula for the aesthetic experience is that it does not move you to want to possess the object. That he calls pornography. Nor does it move you to criticize and reject the object. That he calls didactic, social criticism in art and all that kind of thing. It is beholding the object. And he says you put a frame around it and see it as one thing. And then seeing it as one thing, you become aware of the relationship of part to part, and the part to the whole, and the whole to each of the parts. This is the essential aesthetic factor, rhythm. The rhythm. The rhythmic relationships. And when a fortunate rhythm has been struck by the artist, there is a radiance. That's the epiphany. And that is what would be the Christ coming. Do you understand what I'm saying?
The face of the saint beholding God.
And it doesn't matter who it is. I mean, you could take someone who you would think of as being a monster. That is an ethical judgment on the life. And this is transcendent of ethics, no didactic.
See, that's where I would disagree with you, because it seems to me in order to experience the epiphany, that which you behold but do not want to possess must be beautiful in some way. And a moment ago when you talked about your peak experience running, you said it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful is an aesthetic word.
That's right.
And how can you behold a monster?
I tell you, there's another emotion associated with art, which is not of the beautiful, but of the sublime. And what we call monsters can be seen as sublime. And they represent powers too great for the mere forms of life to survive. Prodigious expanse of space is sublime. Mm. This is the thing that the Buddhists know how to achieve in their temples. Particularly when I was in Kyoto, I was there for 7 glorious months.
In Japan.
Yeah, visiting some of the temple gardens. They are so designed that you're experiencing something here, and then you break past the screen and a whole new horizon opens out. But somehow with the diminishment of your own ego, the consciousness expands. It's this experience of the sublime. Another experience of the sublime is not of tremendous space, but of tremendous energy and power. And I have known a couple of people who were in Central Europe during the saturation bombings that were conducted over those cities. And there is you just have the experience of the sublime there.
I once interviewed a veteran of the Second World War, and I was talking to him about his experience at the Battle of the Bulge with the assault of the Germans about to succeed. And yeah. I said, well, as you look back on it, what was it? And he said, it was sublime.
And so the monster comes through there.
What do you mean by monster?
Well, by a monster, I mean someone who breaks all of your standards for harmony and for ethical conduct.
Is there a story in mythology that illustrates the sublime in the monster?
Well, the god of the end of the world, Vishnu at the end of the world, is a monster. I mean, good night, he's destroying the world, first with fire, and then with a torrential flood that drowns out the fire and everything else, and nothing's left but ash. The whole universe has been wiped out. That's God.
Well, the Christian millennialists talk of the rapture.
Well, read chapter 13 in Mark.
Which says?
That's the end of the world. You see, these are experiences that go past ethical judgment. The ethics is wiped out. Our religions, with the accent on the human, as I mentioned a little while ago, also stress the ethical. Yeah. God is good. God is horrific. The end of the world. There's an Arab saying that I read somewhere in the Arabian Nights of the angel of death. When the angel of death comes, it is terrible. When he has reached you, it is bliss. Now, in the Buddhist systems, particularly as we get them from Tibet, the Buddhas appear in two aspects. There's the peaceful aspect, and there is the wrathful aspect of the deity. Now, if you're clinging to your ego and its little world and hanging on, and the deity wants to open you, the wrathful aspect comes. It seems to you terrible. But if you are open, and open enough, then that same deity would be experienced as bliss.
Well, Jesus talked of bringing a sword, and I don't believe he meant that in terms of using it against your fellow, but he meant it in terms of opening the ego. I came to cut you free from the binding ego of your own self.
This is what's known in Sanskrit as viveka, discrimination. And there is a Buddha figure called Manjushri, who's shown with a flaming sword over his head. And what is the sword for? It's to distinguish the merely temporal from the eternal. It's the sword that distinguishes that which is enduring from that which is merely passing. The tick, tick, tick of time shuts out eternity. And we live in the field of time. But what is living in the field of time is an eternal principle that's inflected this way.
What's the eternal principle?
Brahman.
Which is?
Well, we call it God, but that personifies it, you see.
It is the experience of the eternity.
Yeah.
The experience of the eternal.
As what you are.
Yes.
I would say.
That whatever eternity is here right now.
Or nowhere else. Or everywhere else. If you don't experience it now, you're never going to get it. Because when you get to heaven, that's not eternal, that's just everlasting. Heaven lasts a long time. It's not eternal. It's everlasting.
Well, I don't follow that now.
The eternal is beyond time. The concept of time shuts out eternity.
Time is our invention.
Our experience, yeah. But the ultimate unqualified mystery is beyond human experience. It becomes inflected, as they say. There is a condescension on the part of the infinite to the mind of man, and that is what looks like God.
So whatever it is we experience, we have to express in language that is just not up to the occasion.
That's it.
It's inadequate.
That's what poetry's for. Poetry is a language that has to be penetrated. It doesn't shut you off. It opens. It's the rhythm, the precise choice of words that will have implications and suggestions that go past the word is what has to happen. And then you get what Joyce calls the radiance, the epiphany. The epiphany is the showing through of the essence, what Aquinas called the quiditas, the whatness. The whatness is the Brahman.
Why do you think it is there is in so many people this deep yearning to live forever, to secure my place in heaven?
When you realize what heaven is, in the works of such a person as Thomas Aquinas, it is the beholding of the beatific image of God, which is a timeless moment. You know, time explodes. So, again, eternity is not something everlasting. And you can have it right here now in your relationships. I've lost a lot of friends, and my parents and all. And a realization that has come to me very, very keenly is that I haven't lost them. That that moment when I was with them had an everlasting quality about it that is now still with me. What it gave me is still with me. And there's a kind of intimation of immortality in that. Do you see what I mean?
But in the sense that you were talking about eternity beyond the body.
Yeah.
Experienced now in the body,
yes.
But being beyond time. Has anybody told a story that...
Well, there's the story of the Buddha who encountered a woman who had just lost her son, and she was in great grief. And the Buddha said, I suggest you just ask around to meet somebody who has not lost a treasured child or husband or relative or friend. And this business of understanding the relationship of mortality to something in you that is transcendent of mortality is the big job. Now, there's a wonderful work of Schopenhauer's. He says, when you reach a certain age, and he wrote this when he was, say, in his 60s or so, and look back over your life, it seems to have had an order. It seems to have had been composed by someone. And those events that when they occurred seemed merely accidental and occasional and just something that happened turn out to be the main elements in a consistent plot. So he says, who composed this plot? And he said, then just as your dreams are composed by an aspect of yourself of which your consciousness is unaware, so your whole life has been composed by the will within you. Then he says, just as those people whom you met by chance became effective agents in the structuring of your life, so you have been an agent in the structuring of other lives. And the whole thing gears together like one big symphony, he says, everything influencing and structuring everything else. And he said, it's as though our lives were the dream of a single dreamer in which all the dream characters are dreaming too, and so everything links to everything else, moved out of the will in nature. It's a beautiful idea. It's an idea that occurs in India in the image of what's called the net of Indra, or the net of gems. It's a net of gems where every gem reflects all the other ones. And they also have the idea of a spontaneous and simultaneous arising. Everything arises in relation to everything else, and so you can't blame anybody for anything. It's all working around. It's a marvelous idea. It's as though there were an intention behind it, and yet it all is by chance. none of us has lived the life that he intended.
And yet, we all have lived a life that had a purpose. Do you believe that?
I don't believe life has a real purpose. I mean, when you really see what life is, it's a lot of protoplasm with an urge to reproduce and continue in being.
Not true. That's not true.
Now, wait a minute. Just sheer life can't be said to have a purpose, because look at it, on all the different purposes it has all over the lot. But each incarnation, you might say, has a potentiality. And the function of life is to live that for potentiality. Well, how do you do it? Well, again, when my students would ask, you know, should I do this, should I do that? Dad says I should do this. And my answer is folly or bliss. Yeah. There's something inside you that knows you're in the center, that knows you're on the beam, that knows you're off the beam. And if you get off the beam to earn money, you've lost your life.
So it is not the destination that counts, it's the journey.
Yes. There's a wonderful old man, I think he's still alive in Germany, Graf Durkheim. And he says, when you're on a journey and the end keeps getting further and further away, then you realize that the real end is the journey. It's not bad. This is it. This moment now is the heavenly moment. And
I like the idea that Eden was not, Eden will be.
Eden is. The kingdom of the Father spread upon the earth and men do not see it. I mean, Eden is.
There's some image of Shiva, the god Shiva, surrounded by circles of flame, rings of fire.
That's the dance of the world, the dancer whose dance is the universe. And in this hand, he has a little drum that goes tick, tick, tick. That is the drum of time. The tick of time which shuts out eternity. And we are enclosed in that. In this hand, there is a flame which burns away the veil of time and opens us up to eternity. And in his hair is a skull and a new moon, the death and rebirth at the same moment, the moment of becoming.
That's a powerful image for any life.
Well, the goal of your quest for yourself is to find that burning point in yourself, that becoming thing in yourself, which is fearless and desireless, but just becoming. This is the condition of a warrior going into battle with perfect courage. That's life in movement. A plant growing, I think of grass, you know. Every 2 weeks a chap comes out with a lawnmower and cuts it down. Suppose the grass were to say, well, for Pete's sake, what's the use? It's the coming into being, that's it. And that's the life point in you. And that's what these myths are concerned to communicate to.
Well, I've always interpreted that powerful, mysterious statement, the Word was made flesh, as this eternal principle finding itself in the human journey,
yes,
the human experience. Now, I don't know what the Word is, and I don't even know what flesh is. But I know that there is that experience of epiphany when you meet what you don't know and understand it.
Yeah, and you can find it in yourself too, the Word in yourself.
Where do you find it if you don't find it in yourself?
Well, right. Goethe says, all things are metaphors. Alles Vergängliche ist nur ein Gleichnis. Everything that's transitory is but a metaphorical reference. That's what we all are. And to see the Word. We're getting back to that. Your radiance that we spoke of before comes out here again now.
But how does one worship a metaphor, love a metaphor, die for a metaphor?
Well, that's what people are doing all over the place. That's what people are doing all over the place. Dying for metaphors. And when you really realize the sound om, the sound of the mystery of the word everywhere, then you don't have to go out and die for anything, because it's right there all around. And just sit still and see it and experience it and know it.
Explain om. That's the first time you've used that.
Well, om is a word that, what can I say, represents to our ears that sound of the energy of the universe, of which all things are manifestations. And om, it's a wonderful word. It's written A-U-M. You start in the back of the mouth, ah. And then ooh, you fill the mouth. And mm closes at the mouth. And when you pronounce this properly, all vowel sounds are in that pronunciation. And consonants are regarded simply as interruptions of om. And all words are thus fragments of om, as all images are fragments of the form of forms of which all things are just reflections. And so om is a symbol, a symbolic sound that puts you in touch with that throbbing being that is the universe. And when you hear some of these Tibetan monks that are over here from the Gyuto Monastery outside of Lhasa, when they sing the om, you know what it means, all right. That's the zoom of being in the world. And to be in touch with that and to get the sense of that, that is the peak experience of all. Birth, the coming into being, and the dissolution, the cycle of that. And this is called the four element syllable. What is the fourth element? Ah, oo, mm, and the silence out of which it comes, back into which it goes, and which underlies it. Now my life is the ah, oo, mm, but there is a silence that underlies it. And that is what we would call the immortal. This is the mortal, and that's the immortal. And there wouldn't be this if there weren't that.
The meaning is essentially wordless.
Yes. Well, words are always qualifications and limitations.
And yet, Joe, all we puny human beings are left with is this miserable language, beautiful though it is, that falls short of trying to describe.
That's right. And that's why it's a peak experience to break past all that every now and then, to realize, oh, ah, I think so.
This has been a Highbridge audio presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.